Hi, I'm Len Epp from Lean Pub, and in this episode of the Lean Pub podcast, I'll be interviewing Romano Roth. Based in Zurich, Romano is Global Chief of Cybernetic Transformation at Global Innovation Service Provider Zuka, and a thought leader in cybernetic transformation, enterprise evolution, and platform engineering with over 2 decades of experience in the technology sector. You can follow him on X at Romano Roth and check out his website at romanoroth.com. You can also check out his YouTube channel at Romano Roth and follow him on LinkedIn at Romano Roth. Romano is the author of the book, The Cybernetic Enterprise, How to Build a Future-Ready Organization. In the book, Romano provides readers with a comprehensive operating system for navigating the next era of business transformation. If your company has adopted Agile and DevOps, but still struggles to adapt at scale, fast team, slow enterprise, this book is for you. In this interview, we're going to talk about Romano's background and career, professional interests, his book, and at the end, we'll talk a little bit about his experience writing a book. So thank you very much, Romano, for being on the Lean Pub podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I always like to start these interviews by asking the guest for their origin story. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you found your way into a career in, you know, tech.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Basel. This is in Switzerland, and it's north of Switzerland, right at the border to Germany and to France. There I went to school, and after my school, I went into an apprenticeship in civil engineering. And during my time in civil engineering, I needed to draw quite a lot of plans by hand. But during that time, this was in the 1994. The internet came and computers came, and I loved computers already at that time. I played quite a lot of games, and I did quite a lot of stuff with the computer. I was always the first to use the computer, also already at school. And also during my apprenticeship, I loved to draw plans on the computer. Now, during that time, this was not the case. So when you wanted to do the final exam, you needed to draw it by hand. But I did all of my drawings already by a computer. So I went to the school and said, "Hey, can I do it with the computer?" But unfortunately, I was told, "No, it's not possible. It's not expected. You need to do it by hand." So after my apprenticeship, I went to university to study technical information science. I went through that, and during my time there, we visited different companies. And one of the companies we visited was Zuka, the company I'm still in there. So directly after university, I applied at Zuka and started there as a junior .NET engineer. Zuka is a global innovation provider. At that time, it was 250 people. It's really an engineering company. It was founded in 1969 by Gary Zuka. That's where the name comes from. And it's pure engineering. And so I went there from junior software engineer to advanced software engineer, then expert software engineer, lead software architect, principal consultant, and then distinguished consultant. And this is sort of where I'm coming from.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing that. You know, we have authors from all over the world. I'm in a strange place called Saskatchewan right now. I just wanted to ask you a question about growing up in Basel. Did you grow up speaking French?
No, and this is also quite a funny thing. Basel is German speaking, but of course in school you learn French. And I always say I didn't learn French; I learned to hate French because our French teachers, they just wanted that we learn all of the exceptions and all of the ugly stuff about French, but we didn't learn to talk French. And this was really a pity. And unfortunately, I'm not able to. I understand French, but I'm unable to talk French.
That's so interesting. To any of our Canadian listeners, they may be very familiar with the experience that you just described. Canada has two official languages, French and English, but most of the country doesn't speak French day to day, and so a lot of Canadians have the experience of being forced to take French in school. So that's one feature of it. I took French immersion, so it was like French in every class, but it was exactly what you described. The sort of like there was a tendency to from some of the teachers to kind of work to the book, get the grammar book out, make sure you know all the rules, instead of just getting you to read and listen to TV, watch TV shows and movies and just talk. And you always feel like you're going to get caught breaking a rule instead of the opportunity to speak a language.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really a pity.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's too bad. And so one question I have, so you've had this career, you sort of moved up the ladder at the company and that you obviously love working for. One question that often comes up on the podcast that I always like to ask people is if they've got a sort of educational background like yours, is if you were starting out with the intention of having a career, in on the technology side of things now, would you go to school and formally study computer science, or would you like university and study computer science, or would you, take a more independent path perhaps?
What do you mean by independent path?
Just studying on your own, online courses, things like that. Yeah.
No, I would always go that path. I think our Swiss system is a little bit different. In Switzerland, you have the possibility to make an apprenticeship. And I really like that, to go through an apprenticeship. At my time, there was no apprenticeship in information science. Now there are dozens directions which you can choose from. And I would always recommend going through an apprenticeship and then going to university and really study computer science. I would not recommend to do it on your own, because having this formal way of learning in universities is quite good. And I must also say, of course, I also hated the stuff that we learned at university. But one thing that I would not miss is they really were hard on teaching us mathematics, physics, chemistry, and everything that we needed to do is always very mathematically. And this taught me quite a lot of abstract thinking, critical thinking, and problem solving skills. And I would not like to miss these. And I think this is something that you can learn very good at university, but not from YouTube videos.
Yeah, thank you very much for that really great answer. It's actually funny. I was just having a conversation with someone recently about how one of the big advantages of taking a degree in university is being forced to take classes that you don't want to take. And it's not just because, now you'll discover, although this is as important as this is, discovering something that you didn't know you should know. But when you go then to work with other people and they find out that you've had this experience, they know that you can tackle things that you find unpleasant because you don't want to, because you understand there's a bigger project at stake.
Yeah.
And that actually sounds like kind of trivial, but like when you take a class in university that you don't want to take, that's 4 months to 8 months, at least in the North American system, that's 4 to 8 months of your life that you're like kind of spending like hours every day thinking about and working on something unpleasant. With the goal of you know doing well in it and understanding it, and that's actually not a trivial thing for say a 20-year-old to put themselves through.
Fully agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good exercise because it shapes you. It's a sort of, you can also think it of like military service. Military service is also not a very, very pleasant thing, but it shapes you in the end. And also when you look at the US Marines, right. I doubt that you are a US Marine by not going through their exercises or through their program.
Oh yeah, though they talk quite from the little about it. The Marines are very explicit about that. They're like, we take you and we shape you, and then teach you kind of life lessons. Even, you know, like that's a very important part of it.
And I think the same applies to school and also to universities, in my opinion.
Okay, great. Well, and so you worked in many different areas, you know, DevOps and Agile and things like that over the years. You know, I'm sort of now sort of moving on to talk a little bit to move on to the subject of your book. I want to sort of just read quote you back at yourself, which isn't very fair. But in the beginning, you have a section called Why This Book Was Written. And you say, we are at a crossroads where incremental tweaks to how we run our organizations no longer suffice. After years of helping enterprises adopt agile methods, DevOps, and large-scale digital transformation programs, I observed a recurring frustration. Even after these well-intentioned improvements, something fundamental was still missing. It's a kind of dramatic opening to the book, and especially given, you know, your experience working in exactly those areas. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what is the something fundamental that you realized was still missing?
Mm-hmm. So I've also... as a consultant, you are engaged in different areas with different clients, and usually, what you can clearly see is they usually start with, we need to transform into agile, or we need more DevOps, or we need to improve how our developers work, and these things, they miss a very crucial thing. Like analyzing what is sort of the root cause. And of course, as a young consultant, I went in there and of course I solved the task. And I can give you an example. For example, we went and we improved the development. So developers were able to deliver more. Now they delivered more, but the problem is now the next stage, the testing, had a huge problem. And then we improved, of course, testing, and then operation had a huge problem. And also in front, like the business bringing all the requirements in, they also had a huge problem. And this is sort of a system, and this is something that I recognized, that we have a system and that we need to zoom out and look at the whole system. And this is sort of also the fundamental thing that is usually missing, that we think we can just throw a sort of a framework at the problem and solve it by using that framework. And this is why I written the Cybernetic Enterprise, because I see all over the place this problem that we focus too much on one thing, and that we did not understand what the root cause is, and we don't have the overview on the whole system, because usually you have a problem maybe on the technology side, but when you want to fix that, potentially you need to adapt the processes, usually always, and potentially, and also again always, you need to adapt the organization to really improve that. Of course you can just improve a process or the technology, but usually it has an impact on these processes, and you don't get really the benefits out of it unless you adapt the organization or adapt the process. And this is why I always say, hey, look, you need to look at all of these three things.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I love that the sort of image of things kind of ratcheting from like one step to the other, where you can't go back, and you just fix it at this stage, fix it at this stage, fix it at this stage without stepping back. And the stepping back in this hole that you're looking at is you have this, that you've come up with the concept of the cybernetic enterprise. And I watched a couple of YouTube videos that you did where you talk about this. It's very interesting. You have one kind of interesting way, you have of capturing people's attention is to say AI is not the future. The future is cybernetic, which I really like. And so I was wondering if you could take a moment to talk about what cybernetic means in this context. And of course, you know, at this point, you know, it's you know, August 2025, we don't need to bring up that AI is the sort of big sort of shaper of all the conversations around, you know, how companies run and things like that. But that's a very striking thing. AI is not the future. So what does it mean when you say the future is cybernetic?
Yeah. So when I went into the whole AI topic, I soon found out that AI is quite nice. It has quite a lot of advantages. I use it every day. But when I look at it, it's for me, it's still a tool in the end that I use, and I use my own intelligence. And during that time, I researched, I was also rewriting the book, and then I stumbled over that term cybernetic. And when you go back to cybernetic, this was around the 1940s when that term came up, cybernetic. And it means that humans and technology, and in our case nowadays AI, are working together in a very closed feedback loop. And this really struck me, because this is exactly what I always say: AI won't replace us as humans. We need to build organizations where AI and humans are working together, or how I say, technology and humans, they need to work together. And when you look at the big examples, for example, when you look at the biggest one, the Mars, the moon lander that the Americans sent to the moon with the people, this is a cybernetic system, a very, very impressive cybernetic system, where humans and technology are working together to achieve something like landing on the moon. And that's a cybernetic system. And also an enterprise is nothing else than a cybernetic system where technology and humans are working in a closed feedback loop together. And now we are coming back to your initial question that you have. What is that thing that is sort of missing? Usually in enterprises, these feedback loops, they are huge. They are large. For example, budgeting process, usually a yearly thing. Now times, the technology moves so fast, markets are moving so fast, tariffs are coming. Companies need to steer much faster. So we need to improve these feedback loops that companies can adapt faster. And this is why I written this book about the cybernetic enterprise, so that companies can transform into a company where you have that fast feedback loop between humans and technology, or AI nowadays.
Yeah, thank you very much for saying that at the end. It's one of the great things about your book is that it both sets out the idea of the cybernetic enterprise and a path for transforming an organization. Which is something most people would do that in more than one book, maybe. But it's great.
I should have done that, because it's too large.
Yeah, I don't know. I personally it corresponds to my way of thinking about things. I would want one book like you did it, but it's great to actually know when you're reading like, as it were, the kind of theory that in the same book the practice is also there. And when you talk about feedback loops, can you give an example of that? Actually, I've got a quote from one of the videos I'd like to say as well. This quote: cybernetic means building adaptive systems where processes, organization, technology, and governance, I believe, cooperate in feedback loops to continuously improve and support the company's business goals. I really like that. I love the adaptive systems idea and feedback loops as well. So we'll get into some sort of specific examples maybe about that. But when you say adaptive systems, what do you mean by that?
I mean, look, when you look at today companies, then everything is sort of nearly set in stone. Today's companies are not really adaptive. When you look at a startup is very, very adaptive. And what I want to bring back with the principles and the practices is that adaptiveness into organizations. And when you nowadays look at an organization, usually you have the organization structure set in stone because you have some heads and they have an area, and it is set in stone that we are going that way because we have that head. The same goes with processes and usually also with technology. Now, when we think about a cybernetic enterprise, then we want to decouple organizational units, and we want to make them more adaptive. We give them more trust, but also more responsibility. And they should be as fast as possible and also as responsive as possible to market demands, which means in the end, when you think that further, then in a cybernetic enterprise, you have smaller units, which are sort of like small startups or small enterprises within a larger enterprise, so that they are very adaptive.
One image I think you have in the book, and I think in one or two of these videos, is of how organizations often kind of grow kind of like, well, the organizations and products can kind of grow in a kind of hodgepodge way. It's like, oh, well, now we need this. Oh, we've grown and now we need this. Oh, customers have told us and now we need this. And then you can end up with something that all kind of hangs together, but isn't really kind of like designed, as it were. And that one of the things about the kind of cybernetic enterprise transformation is thinking about, we've got all these amazing things, but let's turn them into a system.
Exactly. And one of the core things, what you need to do is focus. And don't, I always say to also to my client, don't underestimate focus. Focus is saying no. And you just said, yeah, we have that, and we have that, and we have that. Yeah, all nice, all good. But on what should we focus? And this is usually quite a crucial thing. And I must also say, sometimes I also have difficulties to really focus, because everything is nice, and that would also be a nice thing. And also we as a company, for example, we have the same problem. What is exactly the focus? And finding focus is really difficult. But again, when you want to design the cybernetic enterprise, you need to create units which have a clear focus. Only then you can create the system. And now we're coming to a very interesting thing. When you look at system architecture, when you are architecting a software, you also create that. For example, you create microservice or you create a monolith, but with components, and they have a clear focus what they are doing. They have a clear responsibility. And if you don't have that, you end up with the big ball of mud. And this is exactly what many organizations currently are. And I always say, look, you need to architect your organization as you architect your technology landscape or as you architect your software.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Is that focus, the idea of focus, related to the section you have on the mental model of the cybernetic enterprise? I mean, I really like that you started like really stepping up to that level, like, how are we thinking about this? And I'm just looking at a diagram you have of, and by the way, the illustrations in the book are great, and you have a section about the illustrator in the back, which is awesome. But you know, it goes, this diagram that I'm looking at goes from like purpose through vision, mission, values, capabilities, all the way down to tools at the end. Is that part of the exercise of gaining and confirming that you have focus?
Exactly. And it is it also shows you how everything connects to each other. And this is a very crucial thing, because only by focusing on certain practices or certain principles, you get exactly that focus. Yeah.
Okay. That's great. One thing I wanted to ask about too is so you say AI is not the future, cybernetic is the future, but that means, you know, AI is a big part of the story.
Sure.
And of course, and you talk about embedded AI and stuff like that, and giving people in the organization access to these things. You also have a really great section where you talk about how, like, you know, none of this means we've solved all the problems now. Adopt this and problems go away. It's a way of, you know, it's not like you can predict the future now or anything like that now, but what it gives you a better way of handling things. And as I was reading your book and watching your videos, I was reminded of a lecture series I've been sort of watching lately about Greek and Roman kind of technology. And there was this interesting shift from kind of point where things were basically artisanal. You know, you had to have a mason shaping every stone. And then more or less the Romans discovered concrete, and they could actually kind of mass produce their buildings and roads. And so one of the, you know, and so what they could do is they could kind of design a system for building a road. And you could then have like three or four kind of experts guiding 1,000 people digging the road according to the program, and whether it was in, you know, England or France or, you know, kind of Greece or wherever they were, they could build the same road everywhere because they had formalized a kind of system for doing these things and broken the work down in such a way that you didn't need experts all the way along kind of doing things. And some of the things you were writing about and talking about reminded me of that, of like sort of we're in an organization, you might have experts who can do all the little things together, but if you could come up with a system, you can then, you know, have trust that it's working well over here and well over there and repeat that process in the future.
Exactly. And this is a sort of that chapter about the cybernetic platform, which is the foundation of the cybernetic enterprise, where I always say, when we are creating products, be that digital products or be that AI augmented products or be that cyber physical systems, we need to standardize. And you see that very good at the moment in automotive, where they create platform for cars, and they just look different on the outside, but in the inside they are all the same. And the same applies to digital products. We need to standardize, and this is also why I usually say we are entering now the age of industrialized software development, where we are standardizing. For example, Kubernetes is nothing else than a standardization how we run our digital applications. And here a platform helps massively to get that standard into place, like you said, with the Romans, to build these roads where you can then faster create your applications.
One last thing before we maybe go on to talk about the cybernetic transformation itself. You've got one concept in here that's been coming up. And this question's kind of selfish, but like it's been coming up in my world a lot more, which is the concept of shift left. Yeah. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that concept.
Yeah, I mean, shift left is very important. When you look at sort of the history, organizations tended to create specialized units. So you had the development unit, you had the business, you had the testing. And what you had is when something was produced, it was going from unit to unit. And of course, you also needed to do quality and to do, for example, test security and also, of course, operation. And the whole problem is that when you look at that, this is a value stream. And usually you're doing stuff too late because someone else is responsible. And the whole shift left is all about shifting left the responsibility. In the end, I mean, I also saw that when I am a developer and I know that someone else's responsibility is to do quality on what I'm building, then I don't need to care that much on quality. Of course, I should, but someone else is taking care. Or again, about security, why should I now look at security when I know that someone else will take care about security? And this is why nowadays we are shifting left everything, which means the team is responsible for everything, for the whole application. And the team is a cross-functional team, which has all of the roles in there, which is needed to create that product. And of course, in that quality with that security. This, of course, also means that the cognitive load goes up on the team because they need to be aware about security. They need to be aware about testing and also about operations. And what we do is we bring in automation, and this is the whole shift left, where you check the quality of the software right at the point when the code is produced, and you also check the security right at the point where the code is produced, and this is the whole shift left.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I love the sort of origin of the image, of course, is kind of in the West, at least, we do timelines from left to right. And so we do processes, which is still actually slightly different from a timeline in a way, but conceptually from left to right. I actually first heard the term in a military context, that there was, this sort of like planning, logistics, execution, and then, which means attacking your enemy. But if your enemy gets there first, before you get to execution, you're the one that gets blasted, and so shift exactly. Across. It's some version of that. I was just sort of more sort of, kind of dramatic, but it's very interesting. And like one thing you were making me think of when you were explaining that is that instead like increasing the cognitive load on the team, reminded me of something that you mentioned in one of your videos, which is I think there's a line out there that there seemed to be a certain kind of manager who thinks, oh, we've got AI, we don't need programmers anymore. And one thing I love about your cybernetic idea is that it's sort of like, no. Like, these tools are going to enhance what we can do. But it's actually like when you're competing, it means we have to get a lot smarter about ourselves and about how we do things.
Yeah, and I mean, look. When I was at university, I learned Assembler. This is really the language where you really say the process of what to do. And I also learned how the Pentium processor is executing each command. And I don't know the number, but our computers are making every second millions of commands. And I really learned how they do that. And I learned how to program that. And that's the assembler language. Now, then I learned C, which is sort of an abstraction on top of that. And then came C++. And short before I was finished with university, Java came. And this was a paradigm shift. And there were managers which were saying, we need not so many developers anymore, because now we have Java. Because now you can build a much complex application with less developers. The exact opposite was the case. You needed more developers because you could build crazy stuff more on top of it. And the same goes with AI. AI enables us to create even more amazing products in the end. And now we are coming to AI. I mean, I use AI every day. In the meantime, I don't even Google for a tool anymore. I directly go to ChatGPT and I create that tool for me. Now, when I do that, this tool really serves exactly that purpose. And what I also tried is to create, for example, a more generic tool. And as soon as I go into this process. And as soon as I, for example, wipe code for more than 2 hours, I experience quite an interesting thing. Everything falls apart. And what I learned for me is what you need to do in order to get it right is engineering practices, really creating tests, engineering the system, telling the system what to do, defining the context, designing it. And that's a very important thing that many have not yet understood. They think we can now build faster software. But when you look at the software development process, then when you look at the day of a software developer, then programming, typing was never the bottleneck. It's usually perhaps 30% of the time where a developer really types stuff in. And at the moment, AI or all of these managers are focusing on that, on saying, yeah, we will leverage that and make that faster. Yeah, of course, you can do that faster, especially when it comes to boilerplate code. But there is much more. You need to think a problem through. And of course, AI can help there. You need to create tests so that you can ensure the quality of this. But of course, again, AI can help there. But nevertheless, when you look at that, then AI will not completely replace any developers. Developers are needed to give context, to engineer stuff, to see the bigger picture, and to really dive into the problem, perhaps, of course, together with AI. But it is really the engineering that is extremely important in the future. And so I'm pretty convinced that AI will not replace us, at least for sure, not with the current approach, which is the large language models, which I'm very sorry, they are just some pattern matching engines.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I mean, really amazing answer. And I love sort of bringing out the kind of the deep nature of what engineering principles are and the different ways that they actually apply to the way the world around us and building things. And that I think that anyone who's used, you know, ChatGPT and stuff like that to build things knows exactly what you mean when you talk about things falling apart after a while. And how you sort of are confronted with, you know, they sort of like got you in this kind of heady flow of this and that. Oh, this is amazing. And then at the end, you're kind of like,
it
melts.
And the funny thing is, sometimes I'm vibe coding stuff and then something does not work. And I just go copy the error message and say, fix it. And then again, try again. Fix it. After 10 times, now I need to start up my brain. And you need to start up. And it's really painful to start again your brain. And for me, also sometimes a little bit scary.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. One thing that's very interesting too is that when we talk about like engineering, we easily fall back on, you know, roads, aqueducts, skyscrapers, you know, moon landings, things like that. And then it's not that much of a stretch to go from engineering things to like organizational principles, processes, and things like that. But in that definition of cybernetic that I read out earlier, you also have this concept of governance that you set alongside those same concepts. And so I was wondering if you could talk about what governance is in the organizational or corporate context.
Yeah. Governance is a very important concept when it comes to that. Usually you have, of course, processes which are closely related to governance. But nevertheless, you cannot fix, for example, ethical things. Especially when we now go into AI, we need to talk also about AI ethics. So how does it react? And this is something you can only solve with governance, not with process, not with organization, and also not with technology. These are governance guiding rules that you as a company need to have. The same goes when it comes to data. How do we handle data? Who has access to what kind of data? This is, of course, also done by governance. And when we then go also up to, let's say, the whole organization, then usually you have the board of directors, you have the CEO, and they are guided by policies, and they are enforced by a governance that an enterprise has. And this is sort of the fourth thing that is very important in a cybernetic enterprise. I always say, get the other thing three right. Usually, an enterprise has already governance. You need to adapt it. But this is usually also something that is very high up on C-level or on board level, where these governance rules are done. And usually, you need to have quite a lot of force to change these governance rules.
Yeah, that leads me to ask. I wasn't intending to ask you about this, but there's something very interesting about the, you know, the world of corporations and stuff like that, where you get to that level of the board and you know the C-suite, where you know there's a lot of politics going on at that level, including things like I use politics very broadly, because sometimes it can be literally politics. But sometimes, you know, it's often very kind of like, you know, well, that, you know, we'd like to make that person CEO, but they're not famous enough. Their last name isn't recognizable enough. Their family, in you know, I'm going to pick on Germany, you know, their family isn't old enough for them to be the CEO of this big company. Does that, like I said, I hadn't intended to ask you, but does that kind of, in a sense, kind of arbitrariness create a little bit of, I don't know, difficulty for systematizing organizations just in general?
I mean, sure, it's also part of the culture, and it's difficult to change. I also thought about diving a little bit deeper into that topic in my book, but then I just put it onto backlog. Perhaps I can say it now. I'm working currently on a second book. It will have the code name is The Game of Thrones in Enterprise.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
And there we will dive a little bit more into these systems, and also the focus will be more about conflict and conflict resolution.
Oh, that's really fantastic. Well, I'm very excited to read that book. Just very glad to hear that you're working on those problems too. One thing that happens, we'd also talk about the transformation process. And one thing I like about when you start talking about the transformation process, I think you immediately talk about the outcome in the book. I like how you sort of play on the idea that, oh, people always talk about suddenly an ongoing journey, and you're like, no, there's an outcome. it's not the end of time, but there is an outcome. And you say transformation is complete, not when the program ends, but when the organization has built the capabilities to continuously evolve, learn, and thrive, even without external intervention. And I really love putting that at the beginning. But so you put the end at the beginning, but what's the beginning of the beginning? How does it start? I mean, I think you talk about CEO buy-in and things like that.
Look, in the end, I need to go to Kotter. Kotter has laid that quite nicely out in his book, Leading Change. And this is something that I always check first as a consultant. Do we have a need, a real need, which means the C-level or the management is on a burning platform? That's one thing. So they are with the back at the wall or standing on a burning platform.
Yeah, sure.
Or you have a person or a group of person which really fully buys into that and they want that. And if you don't have that, stop. the change will never happen. You of course you can do a little bit of change, but you will soon put your head onto the ceiling, or hit your head on the ceiling, and that's always a problem. And this is usually something that I make quite transparent right from the beginning. And if you don't have that, if they just want a little bit transform or a little bit of that, yeah, of course you can do a little bit of that, but you don't have these huge outcomes. And this is where I usually say, really, the people need to stand on the burning platform, or you need to have a group of people that really want exactly that.
And you talk about how the adoption needs to be tailored. So what, you've got buy-in, at the C-suite level. And I think any sort of consultant listening who knows what it's like to have been brought in where there actually isn't real desire to do what you've been brought in to do knows how frustrating it can be. And that, yeah, if you don't have that buy-in, you're going nowhere. But you talk about how it begins with sort of tailored adoption. So every organization is different. Every organization has different, literally different people and literally different history and different mission. And we're none at all, perhaps at this stage, if everything's burning up, that might be the problem. And you talk about starting with pilot teams and starting small to go big. Yeah. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the pilot team method.
Exactly. So where I'm not really a big fan of is making these large transformation where you transform everything. Because the danger is that it does not turn out as planned is quite huge, and that you also create quite a lot of mess and also destroy things that are working correctly. And you don't know all of the system. And this is sort of, again, feedback loops. You are probing in the system with a smaller team if that works. And of course, you need to create sort of a bubble around that team. And here again, the management support is very, very important, because they need to hold their hands over that, so it does not get crushed by the rest of the enterprise. And then you give them all of the responsibility, all of the tools, so that they can transform themselves. And you have a look at that. And here it's very important. Move fast in fast feedback loops, measure and learn. That's very important. And with that, you see what works in that company and what does not work, where they hit a wall or where they can strive. And from there, you learn how to do that with other teams, and then you scale it to other teams.
Yeah, it's that reminds me of something I've heard from other people who have engaged in corporate transformation, who I've had on the podcast and who've written books on LeanPub, is having a team adopting your process and succeeding at it and being excited, like they can't wait to come to work the next day. And particularly if there's assessment, which you talk about, if there are assessment procedures in place also to go along with this, and they're actually getting assessed and they're meeting it, and they get a chance to show, and the empowerment that they feel, then other people see it. And yeah, that's the way to of course, one way to go do things is a PowerPoint presentation, bullet points and stuff like that, which is an important part of processes sometimes, but actually having a team going, like at I don't know, the cafeteria or whatever, you wouldn't believe it. This thing's actually working. We're all 10 times more productive, we're actually happy to come to work today. And we see where we're going and what we're a part of now. Having just a group of people who are there who can say that, that's the best way to get sort of adopted.
Absolutely.
Spreading through.
Absolutely.
The organization. Well, there's a lot more in the book that we could talk about. Like I said, it's very comprehensive, and it's very, very well structured, and the parts interact. When you get further on in the book, you know why you were told what you were told earlier on, which is always the best kind of reading experience. But we don't have forever to talk about it today, so I just thought we'd move on to the last part of the interview, where when the guest is an author, we talk about their experience writing. You write at the back of the book about your experience writing. So there's something in there for readers as well. But what was your approach to writing this very big book? Did you they're structuring the book and they're structuring your time, which are the two biggest kind of things that authors either confront or don't confront. So did you structure the book in advance? Did you have like an, did you like, before you wrote any content, just like structure it, this is how I want it to go?
Yeah. I mean, I learned so much in writing a book. It's just amazing. So first of all, what I did is I listed what I want to talk about in that book. And I brought it into a structure. And this structure, I think it lasts roughly perhaps a month.
Okay.
And then it was over. Yeah. And the point is, when you look at the book, how it is now, I don't know exactly the number. I used GitHub to develop it together, of course, with LeanPub. But I have over 10,000, 20,000 commits. Which also means that I had quite a lot of restructuring in the book. So, for example, in the end, you see the body of knowledge, and I started with the book with the body of knowledge.
Okay.
So the whole body of knowledge was in the beginning. It was sort of telling the audience, and that was my plan. Look. From there we are coming, and when you pull all of that down, then the following practices and principles coming out, and they are now in the cybernetic enterprise. And the Manuel Pais, the author of Team Topologies, he was a keynote speaker at one of my conferences, and I had a good chat with him, and he said, Romano, I have written a book, but I used a lecture, which did a development lecture on the book. And after that, the book was much, much better. So I went, he also advised me to a lecture. I went to her and she reviewed my book and gave me 18 pages of feedback.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, okay. Of course, she said, hey, great book, all good. But one of the feedback was a complete restructuring again of the book. And this is exactly what I did according to her input. And I put the main thing that I created sort of for the book completely into the appendix, just to say. And now perhaps an advice, when I would again create such a book, I think I would much more take time on the information structure, how I want to structure the book. And this is, in my opinion, the big learning that I have now done through writing that book. First, the information structure, then identifying the personas, then again, going over the information structure, perhaps you need some changes, and then based on that information structure, create your chapters.
And I really, by the way, I've got to say, I love the body of knowledge section at the back of your book. You know, just for anyone who buys the book, it's this series of concepts and developments and kind of management and systems thinking and organizational thinking, you know, like lean, Kanban, cybernetics, Toyota production system, artificial intelligence, design thinking, systems engineering, waterfall, data architecture, digital engineering. And you get a kind of vertigo looking at it. But if you're familiar with these things, you realize actually how much you know. Just looking at the list of things and the richness of the knowledge that you already have, probably as a kind of, you know, informed reader coming to this. So you started out with a big structure, it all fell apart, and you sort of rebuilt, which is great, and learned something about structuring. But the book. But what about your time? Did you say, like, look, it's Saturday afternoons. My Saturday afternoons for the next year are devoted to this book, or was it like whenever you had free time on the train?
It was more on the free times. But what I thought is, now I'm going to write the book, and roughly in a half a year, I will be done. It took me 2 years.
Right. Okay.
And also writing in the free time. Yes, that works for some of the chapters, but the heavy lifting was done through the big holidays during December and January, and through July and August, when in the consulting industry not so much is going on. I blocked my time and really worked hard on it. And this is also a second recommendation. If you really need to work on the structure, really need to connect the chapters together, making the whole book work, you really need quite a massive amount of time.
Yes, this is the ancient lesson of the author, is just how much time it takes to write it.
Yeah.
And this is now, with all of this said, this is a preview edition, as you write about, that it's an early release. It's complete but not final. You're saying the final edition will be launched in the fourth quarter of 2025. And you say you're gathering real-world feedback true to the cybernetic mindset. So how are you? So that's easy to say, I'm gathering feedback. How are you gathering feedback?
It's very cool. I have a group of people where we are reading books together. We do that on a remote basis. We have our Miro board where we put stuff, and we always have a schedule where we read some chapters. And also out of that group came to this idea to create to write that book, because we read, for example, Industrial DevOps or Transformed and so on. All of these books were inspirations for me, because what I saw is they didn't get the full picture. They were only focusing on some of the aspects, but no one is really focusing on the whole picture. And now what we have created is, of course, we are reviewing my book at the moment, and I get quite a lot of feedback from them. But also at Sylke, quite a lot of people are reading at the moment the book, and also getting some feedback back to me. But also to the audience, if you have feedback, I'm very, very open. I also got feedback through LinkedIn already, which is absolutely amazing. So the community is great.
Fantastic. And the last question I have about the book is, why did you decide to self-publish?
Oh, it's quite an interesting journey. But the root of it is Gregor Hoppe. With his book, I think Platform Strategy and what was it, Cloud Strategy. He wrote a blog post. I don't know when. He wrote a blog post about self-publishing and why he did self-publishing. And that was very inspiring for me. And he chose Leanpub. So I went to Leanpub and researched a little bit. And what I saw, what really struck me, was you are using Makua, which in university I used LaTeX, and it's similar to LaTeX. So again, really thumbs up. Okay. And then I can use Git, which is absolutely awesome. It was really, 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 really helpful for me. I mean, when I would never have finished that book with Word. And then you can create webhooks and automatically create your compiled version of the book, which is nothing else than a CI/CD pipeline. And I was like, yes, you got it, DevOps. You can just write a chapter, commit, and boom, you have your book in your hand. And this is just absolutely amazing.
Oh, great. Thank you very much for saying that. And so, it's always so we're always so happy to hear when something just fits with an author like that, that we built and built along with authors sort of asking for things and that they work. So the last question I always like to ask on the podcast, if the guest is a Lean Pub author, is if there was one thing when you were using Lean Pub that you thought if there was one amazing feature we could build for you, one magical feature we could build for you, or if there was something that had you shaking your fist going, damn you, Lean Pub, why is this broken, that we could fix for you? Is there anything you can think of that you would ask us to do?
Good error messages.
Yeah.
When you have compile errors. I had quite a hard time during my thing. But I must also admit, most of the errors was because of me. Because I didn't get the syntax right, because I didn't read the fucking documentation.
Yeah.
all of that. But good error messages, that would be one point. And you can see I used quite a lot of references in my book. And you don't have nothing for that. And that would just be very, very awesome if you have sort of a system where you can really put in all of the references and then reference. I don't know how you want to do it, but that would be very, very helpful.
What do you mean? Do you mean like internal references within the book?
Citation. Sorry, citation. Yeah. I mean that.
Yeah. So
citation.
We do have a kind of formatting thing for that. But what is it that you would want? So
the point is what I did is now I put what is it, the Chicago style I used, where I have brackets and then the name of the author and then I think the year in the text.
Yeah,
and in the back, I just have a chapter where I again have these brackets and then the full citation. And what I would like to have, if I can wish, sort of a database where I have all of that in, where I can, where I get that whole list, but it's also linked so that the user can click on one of them and it's automatically linked back. And there a support would be quite awesome, but no clue how you want to achieve that with Git and Makua.
I see what you're saying. So you've got a bibliography in the back where you not only sort of show like, you know, off last name, first name, title, publisher, place, publisher, date, but you also have the brackets at the front of the reference. And what you would like is someone to be able to, when they come across that citation,
click on it,
context, click on it, go to the bibliography, and then go from the bibliography back. So we do have cross links.
I know.
But
I need to do that manually.
You need to do that manually. So what you're looking for is like, this is a bibliographic reference. Okay. That's very interesting because we do have like an index system for index entries.
Exactly.
And so
I know.
Something like that for bibliography. Okay.
Got it.
That's very interesting. Okay. Thank you very much for explaining that. That's really interesting. I'm going to add that to our discussion queue. That's very cool. Okay. Well, Romano, thank you very much for taking the time out of your evening to talk to me and to talk to all of us to record this podcast episode. The book is The Cybernetic Enterprise, How to Build a Future-Ready Organization. I recommend it for anybody thinking about whatever level you are at in your organization. And even if you're like in a startup and you're going to be in an organization someday, reading this book is a really great grounded way of sort of seeing what the future kind of has to look like for your organization if you're going to succeed. So thank you very much, Romano, for being on the Lean Pub podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as always, thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the Front Matter podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate and review it wherever you found it. And if you'd like to be a Lean Pub author yourself, please check out our website at leanpub.com. Thanks.